This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Scholarly Communications Channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jen Hoyer, and today I'm joined by Janaki Srinivasan, author of The Political Lives of Information, Information and the Production of Development in India. This book was published in October 2022 by MIT Press, and I want to note that it is available open access. The Political Lives of Information examines how the definition, production, and leveraging of information are shaped by caste, class, and gender, and the implications for development. The research presented here examines the history of the idea of information and its political implications for poverty alleviation. Countering claims that information is naturally and universally empowering, The Political Lives of Information shows how the definition, production, and leveraging of information are shaped by caste, class, and gender. Srinivasan uses the concept of an information order to examine how the meaning and value of information reflect the social relations in which it's embedded, and how the power to label some things information and others not is at least as significant as the capacity to subsequently produce, access, and leverage information. Janaki Srinivasan is associate professor at the International Institute of Information Technology in Bangalore, India. Welcome to the New Books Network. So I would love if you could start the interview by saying a few words about yourself, that is where you were born, where you went to school, and how you became interested in information studies.
Thank you, Jen. Thanks for the opportunity, first of all, to talk about my book on this forum. So I was born in Delhi in India and grew up oddly enough, studying to be a physicist and then an information technologist. And I think it was in the course of doing my master's in information technology that I realized that I was probably more interested in how people use technology rather than actually designing that technology. And that's sort of how I got into studying information technology for development. And I should add that I have always been interested in how social worlds work in power and in politics, I guess. So it sort of all came together for me. And I got very interested in information, in the use of information technology for development in countries like India. And I'm talking about the early 2000s when this was a really big topic of discussion, the, you know, questions around digital divide and so on and so forth. So I think that was sort of how I got into this. And then I went on to get a PhD in information systems from UC Berkeley. And I mentioned this because I remember when I joined Berkeley, there was an installation in the library which said information wants to be free. And they basically had all these books hanging from the roof of the library, sort of flapping around. And the whole point was that we don't need those encasings anymore, and information is going to do such great things for us. So I think it was a combination of my own interest in information technology and development, followed by sort of this immersion in this idea of information that I think came together during my PhD. And I've sustained that obsession with this idea of information.
Fantastic. Thank you. So turning to the book, The Political Lives of Information, could you share with us a little bit about the goals of the book and the information order framework that you've used to situate your work?
Absolutely. I think the beginnings of this book were really that when I look at a field like information communication technologies and development, or what is informally called ICTD, many such initiatives that were leveraging digital technologies for development were based on this underlying idea that information empowers people. I was reading a lot about the history of this term information and how it is that, entities across the political spectrum seem to embrace this idea. So that was one set of ideas I was thinking about. But at the same time, if you look at the longer history of technological interventions in development, one concern has also been this concern with depoliticization, that you were basically substituting technology or technical solutions to problems that were fundamentally social, political, and structural. So this idea of depoliticization that runs through development studies, and this idea of information as a game changer or as a development agent, for me sort of came together, and it made me want to understand, well, what role is information playing in social change, in projects of development? Is it depoliticizing that entire process? Is there a potential for information to repoliticize that conversation? So I didn't sort of go into this project saying, oh, information is going to depoliticize development. I genuinely wanted to understand, given the range of entities who seem to take up this idea of information, what were the different ways in which people picked up this idea, and what really was the consequence of that for social change and development. And it was in this context that I came across the historian Chris Bailey's idea of information order. And he is, of course, looking at the 1857 War of Independence in India from colonial rule. And as a historian, he explains that within history, at least, the analysis of information systems and channels was always seen as secondary. They were always consequences of something else, and information systems were never the core object of analysis. And for him, that was a big gap. And he brings up this idea of information order as a way of looking at different information institutions, channels, actors, etc., and to make information important to the analyses of social change that he was carrying out. And that worked for me as well, though I pick it up in slightly different ways. He also brings up this other idea that, of course, the other way in which we think about information / knowledge is a sort of Foucauldian idea of power knowledge. And his problem with that is that those kinds of frameworks tend to treat both power and knowledge as monoliths, right? So they don't actually look at how localized actors engage with with such knowledge. And both of these lacuna are the reasons that he comes up with this idea of an information order. And for me, it was important because the way information is being used in the context that I was studying, its social and material roots very often were not looked at. And for me, the information order provided a way in which I could foreground power relations, the social relations within which information is embedded. And that's why I picked up on that. And I think maybe later on I can say a little bit about how I also went on to modify it. But that was really my reason for using this idea of information orders as a way to foreground the social roots of how information is defined, how it circulates within a particular setting.
Absolutely, yeah. And it allows for like some different lenses of looking at things that I think we're used to talking about without some of the necessary nuance. So then you use that framework in examining three case studies throughout the book, and you describe them and the reasons you chose them in chapter two. So could you share with listeners a little about each of the three cases? I know we'll get more in depth about them as we go, but just to start with, a little about each of the three cases and the reasons you included it. And if you'd like at this point to touch on the methods you used in those cases as well, that would be fantastic.
Absolutely, Jen. So like I mentioned, for me, what was really interesting, and I think part of the one of the major contributions of this book is also the range of actors who picked up on this idea of information. And that is also what guided me to pick the three cases that I did. All of them are fairly prominent cases that advocate for the use of information for social change, but they do so in completely different ways. So the first case that I talk about in the book is the case of price information use among fishers in Kerala. And this case really draws on a very prominent economics study by the economist Rob Jensen, who looks at how the use of mobile phones in Kerala in the late 90s allowed for the incomes of fishers as well as their welfare to change. And his argument is that mobile phones allowed for price information of the fish to circulate more efficiently, created a better market, and that's how it improved the welfare of fishers in that region. So this was a very market-based understanding of how information could transform society. So that was one case. I basically spent 5 months in Kerala in 2012 and 2016 as a participant observer, also interviewing people, everyone basically on the auction grounds in two locations in Kerala, different kinds of fishers, different kinds of sellers of fish, activists who were involved in local fisher people's campaigns and so on. So I basically spoke to a wide variety of actors, interviewed them, also observed what was going on in the beach markets where fish was being sold. So that was one case. The other case was of a nonprofit called the Swaminathan Foundation, which set up digital information kiosks in the southern Indian state of Puducherry or Pondicherry. And the idea really was that you would have these village-level computer centers where people would be provided information about various government schemes, entitlement schemes, livelihood opportunities, etc. And that information would then give them opportunities and allow them to bring about changes to their employment and their lives in general. So this was a case of information provisioning by a nonprofit. And the third was a political campaign by a group called the Mazdoor Kisan Shakti Sangathan, MKSS, which was a collective of peasants and farmers in Rajasthan in northern India, which campaigned for a right to see government records or a right to information which was not a right that existed in India. This would be sort of the equivalent of the FOIA in the US. What I look at are the early campaigns that would eventually contribute to the passage of such a right. And I was looking at the 1980s and the 1990s. Here again, my method was to hang out with MKSS members, participate with them in their current campaigns, and use that as a way to understand what had happened in the 80s and the 90s, and also archival research. This was something that I carried out in 2009. I should mention that in the Swaminathan Foundation case, the Information Village Research Project, also I basically hung out in the villages where these computer centers operated, tried to understand who used them, who didn't, what did they use it for. And I also spent some time with the foundation itself, looking at their archives of when this project was set up, which was in the 1990s. So in all three cases, I used a combination of observation, interviews, and archival research to arrive at what I present in the book. And I should mention, the way I frame the book later, and we'll probably come to this in the chapters, is one of the ways in which we can see these cases is you can see the Kerala case as one where politics was just denied. The idea really was that information can empower anyone. So it doesn't really depend on your social location. It has a value in and of itself, and therefore politics or power relations are really not part of what you need to consider. The Swaminathan Foundation case was interesting because I call it politics bracketed, because it wasn't so much denying that power relations existed within the village community. It was more saying that in the information kiosk, we don't need to think about politics. We can bracket politics. Politics takes place in another arena. The MKSS case, of course, was an explicitly political campaign. So we see these three cases, one which actively says politics doesn't matter, one which says politics might matter, but we don't really need to think of it when we are thinking about information provision, and a third which says the only way to think about information is politically. So given these three cases, how did information really work in practice in these three cases, and what was its relationship with politics is what I set out to explore in the following chapters.
That's a really fantastic introduction to the cases. And I was really impressed at how they give three very clear examples of these different ways of thinking about information in relation to power relations. So as you mentioned, you get more into them in the following chapters. Chapters 3, 4, and 5, you discuss more of them in detail. So the third chapter is going back to this the price fixing case, and that's the fourth chapter. So 4 through 6 are talking about the cases. So starting in chapter 4, looking at this circulation of price information and politics as denied, can you share some of your observations there? And I was really impressed by the extreme quantities of information you saw at play. So I don't know if you can talk a little about that and just how the volume of information was such a part of that case.
Absolutely. So I guess I should say two things. One is that this case was something that studying this case was something that I undertook in collaboration with two other researchers, Jenna Burrell and Richa Kumar. And we essentially framed this research as a revisit of Rob Jensen's work. And our point wasn't so much that mobile phones don't matter or that price information doesn't matter. It was more that in earlier research we had done with agricultural actors in different parts of India and in Uganda, we had basically found that somehow, even though economics tells us that price information should really be on the top of what farmers are always asking for, they didn't seem to be asking for it. It didn't seem to be the crucial thing that was driving how they made their decisions or how they conducted their transactions. And this was very curious, right? Because economics is telling us that it should work in that way. But in practice, of course, people were buying and selling things at a price, but they weren't necessarily structuring who they sold to or how they sold it to them based solely on price, right? That is what got reflected in the research that I carried out in Kerala as well. And one of the first things that I found was, so you have to also sort of picture this. I was in a beach market near Trivandrum in southern Kerala in Virginia. I was standing on the beach and I was just surrounded by all of these boats that were coming in, fishermen who were bringing in the fish, and lots of people who were selling it there. There were auctions going on, and none of it was as tidy as the model that was presented to us said it should. I couldn't like look at that and say, oh, you are a buyer and you are a seller, and you know, here's the fish. None of it was that simple, right? It was just way more messy. And one of the ways in which it was messy and also very interesting is when you actually walked up to the people who were auctioning these fish, because there was no direct buying and selling, by the way. There were auctioneers in between, and in the chapter in the book, I describe in greater detail what the role of the auctioneer is, etc. But basically, in the simplest way to put it would be that the people bringing in the fish would basically go to an auctioneer who would then set a price on that fish and would make these auction cries, and people would respond to them, and that's how the sale of the fish really took place. Now, the interesting thing was, how did this auctioneer arrive at that price, right? He didn't have like a newspaper clipping or something on a blackboard or someone coming and whispering in his ear. None of that was happening. It just literally seemed to just come out of the auctioneer, right? And this was really puzzling to someone who had never been to such an environment before. And I ended up talking to a lot of auctioneers about, well, how do you decide on the price, right? And what became very quickly obvious to me is, while when we talk about markets, we talk about supply and demand and how that decides prices, it became very quickly obvious to me that the auctioneer was actually taking a lot of other factors into account around the quality of the fish, around how many people were there to buy it. Of course, you could argue that all of this is what eventually constitutes price. But my point here is that it didn't just emerge naturally or automatically in any way. There was a lot of friction and there was a lot of calculation that went into how they went about making these. So I argue in this chapter that price is produced. It doesn't emerge, right? And it's produced by the auctioneer. It's produced by the person who's selling the fish, who's buying it, etc. So long story short, what all of this meant was that because there were so many different kinds of actors in that market, there were large-scale sellers, there were small-scale sellers, there were large-scale buyers, small-scale buyers, etc. There were buying and selling relationships that had been maintained over a long time. So people were interested in selling to people who regularly bought from them, even if that meant they were selling it for a slightly different price, etc. So all of these factors together shaped how price was produced. So that is what I go into in more detail in the chapter in terms of what is this range of actors and who among those really cared about price, right? If you're selling like really small quantities of fish, which is what some of the small scale players were doing, they really couldn't afford to bargain too much. If you were a female fish seller and you knew that you had to leave at 3 p.m. to go back home and take care of your kids, which is what society expected you to do, you couldn't really hold out till you got the optimal price. You sold what you could and you moved on, right? If you had been at sea for 5 days and you were really tired, you were not going to hold out till the best price you got. You just sold it at the best possible you could get at that time and leave, right? So all of these factors together shaped price, and it also shaped who was able to use price as a way to structure the transactions. The larger the scale of what you were selling, the more the probability that price mattered to you. The smaller the scale of your operations, price was less likely to be your primary consideration in what you did. So this is what I really go into in this chapter, the production of price, the different actors, the power relations, how religion plays a role, how gender plays a role in who was who played the role of buyer or seller in South Kerala and North Kerala. So, and I guess the reason I call this politics denied is because all of these aspects of someone's social location, I argue in the chapter, really plays a role in whether or not they can use price information. So even though politics was denied, in practice, the way information circulated or how it was leveraged was very much political. It was very much a result of social relations in that community.
Absolutely. Yeah. All of this like very nuanced information brokeraging is dependent on these like different, maybe invisible, but very present power dynamics. Did you get the sense in talking with any of the people involved in different roles that they were aware of like the, I guess the expertise that they had for factoring all these types of information, or was it more of like, no, this is a simple thing. I just do my job.
I think more the latter. That's actually an excellent question, right? Like how people think of, and I think I come to this in the last chapter, what people see as their expertise or their labor in talking about information is really very fascinating. So I think it was really people just saying, well, I have been here a long time, so I really get the fish here, and that's what allows me to quote certain prices. And they would go into sort of a little bit, they'll get a little technical around how they make some of these decisions, but they didn't necessarily see it as a category of skill, right? And actually, that was only part of their skill. Part of their skill was also just the kind of social networks that they cultivated around themselves. And I think I say a little bit more about this in the chapter. But as I conclude in this chapter, I think this idea that price is this one data point which somehow combines all of this and you really don't need to know all of this nuance, to me was just absolutely not true when I was standing there in that market, right? All of these other things seemed so important to understand before you understood price. So while price in an economic sense might capture all of this, for all the people who were working there, it was very important to know all of these different components because they produced that price in some sense. So I think that that question about expertise is great. The other thing I also wanted to bring in was, besides the actors, the history of this place and a very strong, this being Kerala, of course, there was a very explicit culture of collectivization, which really shaped how auctioning worked in this place and even allowed for auctioning to work in the first place, right? So that was also a very important layer of infrastructure for some of these arguments that we are making about how price information circulates. So I think that was all this nuanced understanding of the different actors and who had what bargaining power, I think was also important. Was also a skill, if you will, that everyone in that market, not even just the auctioneers, held. So I think that question of expertise is just so fascinating. And you're absolutely right that it's very, very invisible.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. nubooks.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I think we downplay a lot of our expertise around information. So moving on to the next case study, which you get into more in chapter 5, you're focusing here on Village Knowledge Centers, or VKCs, which focus on attending to information poverty and improving the nature and efficacy of interactions within the state. So you note that these weren't designed to be deeply political, but you argue that they become fundamentally constituted by the range of politics operating in the village. Could you talk more about this and the way it serves as an illustration of bracketed politics?
Yeah. So this project is, again, super interesting. The conception of the project, you could say, starts up in the early 90s in 1992, it comes up when M.S. Swaminathan, who's the scientist who's also often called the father of the Green Revolution in the Indian case, talks about the need to understand how information can make other things being equal, how much would new knowledge and new information make an impact on productivity, profitability, and sustainability. And then the Swaminathan Foundation sort of picks up on this idea, and over the course of the next 6-7 years, it hones this idea of information shops. And the point here really is that villages should not be left behind in the information revolution. And the way to ensure that this doesn't happen is to set up information shops in various villages. If you look at the language of how these information shops are framed, and I get into this in the chapter, they talk about these information shops, which will be managed by educated or unemployed school teachers, students, women of the village, and they will act as information seekers for the village and satisfy the information demands of the village. So information seekers will obtain what they need from among a set of information resource centers using an appropriate communication medium. And basically what they come up with is what they call a hub and spoke model. So basically every village will have this information shop, and this information shop will be fed by what is called a resource center, which would add value to information that they got off the internet. And therefore, this was also a time when connectivity wasn't a given, right? So all villages might not be connected to the internet. So the idea was that the value addition center, which was the hub and which would be connected to the internet, would download all this information about various aspects of people's lives, say agricultural techniques, entitlement schemes, etc., customize it for the villages of Pondicherry, and then the information shops would get this information from the hubs, and that is what village residents would then buy or seek. So one very interesting thing running through the entire conception is the way in which information becomes this thing that can be bought and sold, that is transmitted from person to person, that circulates, etc. And earlier on in the book, I talk about this idea of reification, of this way of sort of bounding your experiences into an object, which is what information has lent itself very well to in many cases, and I think this case is a very good example where that is the way in which information is talked about. And what I mean by information being, politics being bracketed here is that the people designing the project were very well aware that obviously any village community has various political actors, power relations, and layers of power relations which operate in people's everyday lives. But their point was this information shop, which was only going to be selling information or providing information, didn't have to do anything with this politics. It could operate in sort of a parallel realm, if you will, right? And what I do in the chapter is look into how this didn't quite work out that way, right? And what are some of the ways in which it didn't work out that way? So if we If I talk just about government information, information about entitlements from the government, which was one of the categories of information that the project identified through its initial surveys, etc. So the project gets set up through funding from the Canadian IDRC in 97-98. Many of the villages which are run by these volunteers who are later called knowledge workers are very enthusiastic about the idea of culling relevant entitlement information for every village and sort of maintaining a database of it and updating it and so on. So I conducted most of my research for this project in one village that I call Kilipet, which was a scheduled caste or Dalit village. And I remember speaking to knowledge workers there, the early knowledge workers of the center who were also activists, and they were very enthusiastic about building such a database, and they even went ahead and did that. Now, what happened was the trajectory of the overall project. This project was called the Information Village Research Project. I should have mentioned that right at the start. So IVRP, its funding changed over time. Once the IDRC funding dried up, what happened was that the priorities of the information shops and the project itself also had to shift. So to just financially sustain themselves, one of the roles of these knowledge workers actually became to make the centers financially sustainable. So a lot of their energy actually went to finding what they call boundary and strategy partners. And the reason I'm saying all this is that their attention got sidelined from this focus on entitlement. So on the one hand, what was happening was that this entitlement information was no longer being maintained at these kiosks. On the other, what was also happening is that as these VKCs got seen as a part of the village landscape, the local government officials started seeing the knowledge workers at these centers as the people who would authenticate village residents when they applied for certain kinds of entitlement schemes. So you can see how this whole separation of politics and information provision wasn't quite happening, because knowledge workers were constantly being called upon by government officials to say, hey, this person applied for this loan and they say they live in this village. Do you verify it? So they became these sort of verifiers of social facts. And this had many ramifications because these knowledge workers themselves lived in the village, right? So there were repercussions to whether they verified or didn't verify an application. And there are quotes that I have in the chapter where they basically, you can see how they are struggling to, there are many layers of logic, right? First of all, they say we live in the same village. I'm not going to say no to something that they said because I'll get scolded the next day. So that's one line of logic. The other is the government is providing these funds. Who am I to deny anyone of them? So I'll just say whatever they want me to say. And then there's also a third layer where they say, but of course, we are not going to give it to dishonest people, which may or may not. We can have an argument about whether that is right or morally right or not. But the point I'm trying to make here is that the knowledge worker was making all these decisions about who was deserving or not. And all of these are obviously deeply political acts. And this is another way in which the center becomes very political. And then, of course, I also come to some of the factors that the village residents themselves see as crucial to improving their lives. And they really want the center to help those things happen in the village. Now, let me be clear that none of these directly had anything to do with the goals of the center. So I'll give you an example. Identity documents were, when I was doing my research in 2009, and if I look at newspaper articles today, I see that not much has changed. Identity documents are often prerequisites for applying to many of these entitlement schemes. And Kilipet being an SC or Dalit village meant that many of these Many of the people in the village were people who didn't have many of these identity documents. So if I give you one example of a very curious document in which is required in the Pondicherry case called 64 evidence, 64 being the year that the French left Pondicherry. Pondicherry was a French colony within India. And 64 evidence was basically an identity document that you are required to have to show that you're a genuine Pondicherry resident. Now, where do documents come from? They might come from your birth being registered, but of course, most births at this time were home births, so there were no documents proving that. As someone from the village told me, the Dalit community was also the least likely in those times to have attended school, so you won't have documents from school. If you keep adding up like this, what you realize is that this community, which was supposed to benefit from many of these schemes, was also the community that was the least likely to have the identity documents which were prerequisites for them to apply to these schemes. Now, what did village residents want from the center in all of this? They saw the Swaminathan Foundation and the project as very powerful actors. So they wanted them to lend them support in petitioning the state to change some of these rules or somehow make it easier for them to get the ID documents. Of course, this was not something the center had promised, but in the residents' imagination of a better future, it was important that the foundation become this political actor that would then help them achieve these kinds of social change. So this was another way in which the center becomes implicated in the political terrain of the village, whether or not it wanted to be. Hence, the bracketing of the politics we see in the chapter didn't quite work out. So not only is it the cases where politics is just denied, but it can't even be bracketed. That's really how I move on. That's how the argument moves on in this chapter.
Yeah, it's like at every turn, there's a new political nuance that was not imagined for this project.
Absolutely.
It also makes my mind go off on this direction of like the power of philanthropy on information networks, which is definitely like not the focus of your book, but comes through in these cases where money from a variety of actors really has a political and a powerful role in a way that perhaps was not anticipated, but can't be separated out. Let's talk about the third case, which you get into more in chapter 6, looking at right to information advocacy and programming. You study here an explicitly political campaign around the right to information. So could you just describe more about that case and the ways information was quite intentionally leveraged by workers, activists, and the state?
Absolutely. So this is a very interesting case in one very significant way. I mean, it has lots of interesting nuances. But what I was really interested in was just how information was conceptualized. So in the previous two cases, one thing that I hope came across is that when people spoke about information, they were talking about something that was out there, that was objective, that was factual, right? In this case, what was really happening was that MKSS, the group that I, group of activists that I spoke about, saw information in quite different terms. So in a report that they submitted in the late 80s or early 90s, here is how they described information. What is the information available that will lead to action at grassroots levels? It is obviously the information that conceals a potential for legitimate change. Information provided must allow for a shift in perception, to allow the oppressed to see their oppression in stark terms, to allow them to present it to the rest of society in terms they'll be forced to accept. This is in the early 90s. Now, let's also, I also wanted to quote just a little bit from one of the MKSS activists that I spoke to when I was doing my field work. And he says, and I translate from the Hindi, we have all been hearing for a long time that there is corruption, that stealing takes place in welfare schemes. But unless you know the specifics, you won't know what it entails or how it is done. Till you see the documents, you don't know. It was when we got hold of the documents that we saw the difference between the story the documents told and the story we were told by welfare recipients. If these false records are taken to the public, what happens? For there is what the documents say, and then there is what people's tongues say. So what is really interesting in the MKSS case is that information became this thing around which people could contest the state. So let me give you a little bit of context at this stage. So MKSS worked in the northern Indian state of Rajasthan, which saw a lot of famines. And partly as a result of that, there were a lot of public work, famine relief work that would take place in the state. What that meant is that if there was a famine, a work site would be opened up and all able-bodied adults would be able to work on that site, and the government would pay them to work. So basically this was a way of providing work to people at a time when other work such as agricultural work could not take place because of the famine, right? So this is a very broad strokes description of how famine relief works, much more detail in the chapters. But what was happening was that people would never get paid for working on these schemes. And one of the ways in which that got operationalized is that each of these work sites had what is called a muster roll or a labor roll, on which their attendance would be kept and such. But what the British legacy in India was that we had something called the Official Secrets Act, which basically meant that labor roll was only accessible and seeable by bureaucrats. So the person who maintained it, the bureaucrat who maintained it, was only required to show it to his higher-ups, not to the people who worked on that site and whose names were actually on the labor roll. And of course, as a consequence of this, what had been happening was that all kinds of names made it to the labor roll, and the people who actually worked didn't necessarily get paid, didn't get paid for how long they worked, etc. And there are all kinds of nuances to what is the minimum they were required to be paid, what did they eventually end up getting paid, and I get into the detail of these campaigns in the chapter. But I think what is worth keeping in mind in all of this is that people didn't have access to these documents. And over time, what the MKSS campaigns realized is that unless they had access to these documents, they wouldn't even know what to contest. And long story short, what happens over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, by 94-95, is that MKSS starts doing what are called Jan Sunwais, or public hearings. And what they would do is they would get copies of these documents, sometimes through a friendly bureaucrat. In some cases, there was a local order which allowed them to get these, get access to these records. They would, at the public hearings, contrast what these documents said, like that quote mentioned, to what people said. So people would come up and talk about how some of the names on that list didn't exist. They were names of dead people. They were names of people who worked in other states, so they could not have been at the famine relief site. There was one particularly strange one where basically the paper showed that apparently an animal hospital was built, but it was built on the first floor of a building, which is obviously ridiculous, because how were you going to get the animals up there? So there were all these kind of ridiculous stories that came out. But what I want to really point out here is that all of this campaigning, all of this political action was arranged around an idea of information, which wasn't so much about information as objective or as fact or as capital T truth. Instead, it was an entry point that allowed for people's versions of what happened to be contrasted with what the state was saying happened. And that then opens up all kinds of pathways to holding the state accountable, etc. Or that was the goal anyway. And what I do in the chapter is go through till 1996, when the first 40-day right to information sit-in was held in the town of Biawar in Rajasthan. And really what I try and do here is how this idea of information is malleable and fungible enough that even though this started at famine relief works and with working class residents of villages, over time, it got the support of middle-class residents of some of the neighboring towns. Everyone had a hook into this conversation, right? Information was a fungible enough word that you could see how it fit into everybody's lives. So that was one of the advantages of this term. I mean, I'll argue later that the ambiguity also has certain costs, but one of the benefits was that the fungibility of the term allowed for everyone to feel that they understood what it meant, but at the same time, they could also frame it slightly differently for it to be relevant to their lives, right? So this process really shows how information was conceptualized by this campaign, why it felt like a good way to take forward this campaign around accountability and transparency and rights of citizens in a state and frame it around this idea of information. And of course, 1996 was just one campaign. India eventually got a right to information only in 2005. And in many ways, the act is in great danger in present-day India, but that is all part of a different story. That's not what I get to in this chapter. But really, I wanted to highlight today also that this is a very different idea of information than the previous two cases that I was talking about.
Absolutely. The way information is understood and made use of in each case is quite different. So then after presenting these three cases, you compare them in Chapter 7 by asking of each what counted as information, how that was produced, and how that was leveraged, which I think we've touched on a bit in talking about each of them. And then you put this into dialogue with Bailey's idea of an information order. And I think this is where, as you referenced at the start of our conversation, you developed on his conception of information order a little bit. Could you share some of the conclusions that you came to from that analysis and some of the ways that you shifted his information order?
Absolutely. So there are two or three contributions that I see. One is, of course, I should say that what Chapter 7 does and what the idea of information order allowed me to do was, instead of seeing information as this thing that just circulated and had value and had certain attributes or properties, by thinking of it in terms of an information order, I was able to bring in all of these different actors that we have been discussing, their priorities, how power operated, etc., and what is it that really gave information value in their particular lives, right? Rather than seeing information itself as somehow intrinsically valuable and equally valuable to everyone. So I really have the information order framework to thank for being able to look at the production and leveraging of information in this way. That said, I think given the very different context in which Bailey used this idea and I do, I think there are a couple of things I wanted to point out here. One is that I try and pay attention to how the information order worked in theory and in practice. And I think this is especially interesting in the MKS's case, where I point to how the minimum wage act was challenged, and I think the details of this are more in the chapter, but the point really is that sometimes the law would change, but it didn't really mean anything for how things worked on the ground, because they continue to work the same way. So the court basically said that you do have to pay a certain wage, but the local council or panchayat did not pay that wage. And that was what a lot of the campaigns became about. But I think there's this distinction between how rules in an information infrastructure are supposed to operate, but how they actually operate on the ground. So this difference between conception and practice is one thing that I think I bring to the conversation. The other thing that I bring, and I think this is very much because of the times I'm doing this in. Now, Bailey was talking about information in 1857, and I don't think people talked about information necessarily in the same way at that time, in whatever language. So in a sense, it's him taking his framework and lens to look at a time when the people of that time probably were not using the same language. But I'm applying it to today's time where of course, everybody uses the word information all the time. And we say we live in an information age, we have gone through an information revolution, and I think relatedly similar claims around data, etc., right? And what I try and show in this chapter and the next is also how this very rhetoric around information needs to be part of how we think of an information order. So how an information order operates, how it is shaped by a social order, how the information order shapes a social order, all of these are threaded through also by our ideas about information. So one of the things I argue and I contribute to this idea of to this heuristic of an information order, I think, is that ideas about information are also part of an information order, not just the information channels, the agents of information, etc., which Bailey talks about. So I think those are a couple of contributions. And the third is, I think, the idea of information order, the lens allows us to think about politics. But I think we need to get more granular. And what I see through my cases is that politics itself is of so many different kinds. There are so many types of politics, right? So this is not about the information order itself, but I think using the information order allows me to see that there are so many different types of politics. And I've been pushing back against this idea of reifying information in the whole book. So I shouldn't be reifying politics. And that is what the next chapter goes on to. But I think those are some of the ways in which I try to extend this idea of information order for the kind of cases that I'm looking at.
Definitely. And I think that those allow us to, as you have then used the information order concept in ways that I'm sure Bailey never imagined possible. I'm sure he never imagined the time and place that we are in. I think that really paves a way for others to use this as a mechanism for analysis. So then in the final chapter, you've arrived at this realization about the use of the term information and the power dynamics of information, the nuance that's really important here. And this also leads you to suggest some areas for further research. I would love if you could share some of those ideas that come up in the last chapter.
Absolutely. So I think I spent some time in the last chapter looking at these different types of politics, and I'm basically pointing to the idea that, of course, there are things like explicit political campaigns, which are what would fall under the category of organized politics. But of course, there's also this idea of politics of stealth, and we see this a lot, especially in the Pondicherry case, for example, where people don't necessarily want to take their demands through explicit political campaigns, but they've figured out ways in which they can make claims on different actors and also the state, right? So I go a little bit into that. And I also touch on this idea of how in any of the cases that I look at, in any such initiative, there are multiple processes going on. So you are thinking in terms of abstract ideas like information, which automatically disembeds the circulation of information from the sites at which you're talking about it. But then when you have to put it in practice, you have to sort of recontextualize it. I make the point that whenever you have to recontextualize something, you need the people associated with the project to be able to do that. And I wonder if that creates new centers of power, and this would look different in the three cases, and the chapter sort of goes into that. But that is one thought that I was left with. In terms of, you know, areas of research that that probably can come out of my work. One, I think Jen, you already pointed to, is I don't really get into the labor that is performed by the various actors that I'm talking about, whether it's the auctioneer or the knowledge workers, because when the conversation is about information, and information is itself seen to have this value and agency, and it's supposed to lead to certain consequences, you don't really think about who is handling this information. And if you think about information as something that is just transmitted from person to person, you don't really think about the person who's doing the transmission as doing any labor. But what I saw in every instance is that there was a lot of skill and expertise involved in how this thing that we call information was passed from person to person, was transformed, was leveraged, any of those things that I've been talking about. So I think the question of information labor and expertise is one that I think needs a lot of work, and it can come up in both places where you explicitly call it information workers, but I think there are many people who are called other things who are probably also performing this labor that needs looking at. I also touch on this idea, which I've looked at elsewhere as well, of information determinism. So while many of us who study STS might be familiar with this idea of technological determinism, so this idea that technology leads to certain kinds of outcomes, and there have been so many critiques of that, and I think over time we have learned how to identify determinism and also maybe to avoid it. But I think information determinism is a much more insidious creature in a way, because it intuitively feels right to us. When someone says information empowers, I think we would be much more amenable to going along than if someone says nuclear plants or I don't know, mobile phones are going to lead to world peace, right? So information determinism is something that we need to, I think, be very, very careful of, because it again shifts agency away from states, other entities, from different kinds of actors, and puts all agency into information. And I think that's problematic for many, many reasons. And also, I think the larger point which I arrive at by the end of the book is also that this very idea of information as something that sits in certain repositories or people's heads or wherever is actually problematic, right? We need to learn to think about information as something that is distributed in people's thinking rather than, and spread among people rather than individually held by particular individuals or repositories. And this is something I'm still working through, but I think that is something we need to also pay attention to. What do we mean when we mean information? And I should just add one thing. I should have maybe said this when I was talking about Bailey. Bailey sees information as something that is low level enough that everybody agrees with it, right? And that's something that I push back at in various chapters, because you realize that whether you call it information, these days we are calling it data, there is very little that is low level enough that everyone agrees with it. Lisa Gittleman has this great book called Raw Data is an Oxymoron. And I think that's absolutely true, right? And I think there's a tendency to want something that's low level enough that it's right and objective and correct. But what is that thing? I'm not sure it exists. And of course, this has interesting you know, consequences for conversations around misinformation, etc. If you don't have a way of distinguishing between misinformation and information, where are we at? And I think those are complicated questions, but I think we need to rethink how we what we see as information, what we mean by objective information, etc., because before we can even get into that debate. So I also wanted to just flag that.
Absolutely. Those are so many exciting directions for future projects. And we're just about at the end of our time here, but before we wrap up, I would love to hear what you are working on now and whether it emerges from any of these ideas in the conclusion of your book or if you're working on something completely new and different.
Absolutely. I think a bit of both. I think what I got out of this project is that there are certain kinds of people and practices and artifacts that become invisible when we start focusing on digital technologies and information. So I have been quite keen to make these people and practices and artifacts visible in ways that are meaningful to them. And I think a couple of projects that I work on do focus on that. So in that way, it's connected to this project. I've been doing a lot of work on the platform economy, so the Ubers and DoorDashes of the world. And I'm part of what is called the Fair Work Network, which is a global network that works in over 30 countries now. We bring out ratings of platform companies and use that as a way to pressure and improve working conditions of platform labor. So that's something that I've been quite involved in as action research, but also there are theoretical possibilities there that I explore as well. And staying on this idea of labor, I've also been very interested in questions around automation, the politics of automation. So I'm part of a project called Humanizing Automation, where we are looking at various work scenarios and work sites to try and understand how are decisions about what part of that requires automation are made, right? Because very often we hear that the most tedious, lowest skilled, repeatable tasks are what are automated, but who makes decisions about what is tedious and what is low skilled? And that's where the politics comes in. So that's another project that I'm interested in. And of course, like I think everybody today is also thinking a little bit about privacy and AI and bias. So I'm also part of that gang. So I also do that kind of work. But these are basically the directions in which I'm currently exploring ideas.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Once again, my guest today is Janaki Srinivasan, author of The Political Lives of Information from MIT Press. My name is Jen Hoyer, and you are listening to the Scholarly Communications Channel of the New Books Network.